On tonight's programme, I pay a 60th anniversary tribute to the Broadway musical 110 in the Shade. And to introduce it, I shall replay an interview that I recorded with the now sadly late lyricist Tom Jones, who passed away at his ranch in Sharon, Connecticut, on the 11th of August earlier this year, at the age of 95. My featured musical this evening is 110 in the Shade, which is a musical version of the play The Rainmaker by N. Richard Nash. It opened at the Broadhurst Theatre in New York on October the 24th, 1963, where it ran for 332 performances. With music by Harvey Schmidt and lyrics by Tom Jones, it was nominated for many Tony Awards, but unfortunately didn't win any. But nonetheless, it's my very great pleasure to welcome to the program the Tony Award-nominated lyricist of 110 in the Shade, Tom Jones, via Skype from Connecticut. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing well indeed. And how are things in Connecticut?
Know, you were talking about those Tonys. Inga Svensson, who played Lizzie, the leading character, who was absolutely wonderful. We've had some great people play that, including recently Audra McDonald. But Inga would, in a normal year, would have won the Tony as Best Actress in a Musical. But that year, she was up against Mary Martin, B. Lilly, Barbara Streisand, and Carol Channing. Mm-hmm. And guess who won?
Yes, Carol Channing, of course.
Carol Channing, yes, right. And Barbara Streisand never got over it, I don't think. The fact that she was up for two Tonys, once for her first appearance as a supporting actress in the, I can get it for you, wholesale, playing just a supporting actress.
Oh, okay, yes.
But and then she didn't get that. And then she was up for Funny Girl, which normally would have gotten somebody a Tony, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And she didn't get it then. So, but that was the year when everything went to Hello, Dolly.
Indeed, yes, yes. And I've spoken to Sheldon Harnick, and he was disappointed that She Loves Me wasn't even nominated that year either. So I guess you were lucky to get a nomination for 110 in the Shade.
Yes. I mean, you know, it was our first Broadway show, and it was wonderful to be nominated. And I'm very proud of it. It's held up very well, and it gets not nearly as many productions as I think it should. Mm-hmm. But the productions that it's had have had some really wonderful people. I mentioned Audra did it on Broadway in a revival about 7 or 8 years ago, something. I'm 92 years old, so I have no idea about time anymore.
Indeed, really. Yes.
And then before that, Karen Ziemba, a wonderful actress and person, did it in a production, the New York City Opera did it. Mm-hmm. And that with an orchestra of 50 musicians.
Yes.
And that was pretty thrilling for, especially for Harvey. Because, you know, everybody calls us Mr. Off-Broadway, to quote from one of my songs. But the Fantastics always harp and piano. It was something, you know, 50 musicians, that's as many people as we had in the audience for Fantastics sometimes.
Indeed, yes, you get far more orchestral color from that amount of musicians too.
Yeah.
And I've been privileged to read a pre-publication copy of your memoirs, and you write about 110 in the Shade. And something I didn't realize is that The Rainmaker, the original play that it was based on, actually began as a television play.
Oh, that's right. Before it was a play on Broadway, mm-hmm. It was part of, you know, in the 50s, they had that great renaissance in the television industry when it was finding its way and before everything moved to California. When all these great dramatists, many of them, their works then went on to be films like Marty and things like that, and 12 Angry Men and all these writers, mm-hmm. It was a great blossoming. And as part of that, Richard Nash, wrote The Rainmaker, which was a television production.
Yes.
And then that was so successful. And it was done also with, what is her name? Oh, wonderful, wonderful actress whose name I can't think of.
Geraldine Page, you write in your memoirs.
Geraldine Page, right, mm-hmm. Yes. And she did it on stage and then as a film with Katharine Hepburn and Burt Lancaster.
Yes, that's the one I remember seeing on TV years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was an interesting challenge to write it. But one thing, Harvey and I are both from Texas, and so the milieu, and it's sort of set back in the Depression times. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of set back in the Depression times myself. That's when I grew up. Also, it's in a drought, you know, the rainmaker. They get a rainmaker. And I grew up in the Dust Bowl in West Texas.
Okay.
So I knew all about that, you mm-hmm. know.
And it was Richard Nash. Did you ever find out what the N stood for?
Well, I did. I wonder if he would mind my telling you. I think it's okay to tell you, I guess, really. But it was sort of a little secret code for him. His real name was Nathan Nussbaum.
Oh, right.
And the N stood for Nathan Nussbaum.
I see.
And he wrote a lot of things about the West and everything, but he grew up in Philadelphia.
All right.
And he wrote an interesting play called See the Jaguar, which was the first breakthrough for James Dean, you know, like at his start doing that play on Broadway. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, great. And it was Richard Nash himself who apparently came along to see the Fantastics and thought that you and Harvey would be a suitable team to write it. Do you think it was because he enjoyed the song Soon It's Gonna Rain from the Fantastics that he thought you'd be appropriate?
Well, that's almost right, but it's not exactly right. Mm-hmm. The producer, David Merrick, was to be the producer, and Richard, without our knowing it, was actually co-producer.
Yes.
So David had been to see the Fantastics. Richard hadn't, but he went down, and at that point, when we started working on this, the Fantastics had run a couple of years, which gave it a certain respectability.
Yes.
And then we met with Richard. And he said, do you know anything about the West? And we said, well, yes, indeed, we do. And we had been working on a musical that we worked on for another 40 years after that. It's one of my favorite of our shows, but it's never done. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's a show called Roadside.
Yes.
But we played him a number of songs from that, and then he liked those a lot. And then we suggested, why don't you let us, like, lay out how we think it should work. And he said, sure, why not? So we laid out a thing of like taking it out of the original play is all indoors.
Yes.
Inside the ranch house. But to get it outside and to follow to start the musical with the rising of the sun, the hot, hot sun, and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter as things get more intense in the drama. And in the first act at sunset, with her, and I'm sure you probably play this song, Old Maid. It's a really good song, and Inga, it just knocks it out of the ballpark, you know?
Yes.
But
yes.
End that, and then do the second act in nighttime, when it's softer, and that's when the romantic blossoming takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, Richard was happy with all that. We loved working with him. He was very helpful, making suggestions for us, and We overwrote. We were so eager to, with our first Broadway show, eager to do it right and scared of doing it wrong. And like we were stupid, but we were also, because we wrote and wrote too much and deliberately. For every key spot, we would write five songs, different variations.
Yes.
I mean, that's like when you're young, those ever-ready glands. You know, they also, I guess, apply to music and poetry. But anyway, did you ever get this thing I sent you of The Show Goes On?
Oh, certainly, yes, yes, I've listened to that. And you mentioned that you wrote over 100 songs for the show, as well as three different styles of songs for the leading lady, who you didn't know at one stage. You even thought it might have been Mary Martin.
Right. I mean, you're welcome if you want to play that little segment or not. Mm-hmm. But then we do three songs written for three possible stars. None of those songs were used.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was used is one called Raunchy that I think I sent you, Audra doing that at the Tony Awards a few years back. You saw that, right?
Yes, yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So ask me a question and I'll tell you no lies.
Oh, okay? Certainly is. And speaking of raunchy, of course, that became a very popular slang term, I think, in the 1970s. But this was the first time, I guess, that this term was used in a Broadway show back in 1963.
The first time raunchy was used?
Yes, yes. Was it a popular slang term when you were growing up in Texas? Or?
Yeah, yes, right. It's a Texas, yeah, thing when growing up in. And some of those images she mentions, and when she's talking with her father, she says, she can't find a boyfriend, a young man.
Yeah.
She's desperately eager to get married and have a family. And that's what her dream of happiness is.
Mm-hmm.
So she says she's going to go, you know, like peroxide her hair and so forth. And then at one point she says she's going to go down to the Dixie Pig and go juking. Well, my father owned a little cafe in Coleman, Texas, called the Dixie Pig.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Getting
a bit of an in-joke there.
Yes. I mean, you know, I've never been, as I think I mentioned last week, I've never been to Australia.
Yes.
but one of my sons has been there a number of times and liked it a lot. And it's always seemed to me, it's always seemed like Texas to me in a way, except they got sheep instead of cows.
Oh, they do have cattle in the outback, yep.
There was a wonderful film back in those days called The Sundowners.
Oh, that's correct, yes, with Robert Mitchum and Deborah Carr.
Deborah Carr, and that little guy, again, the sort of heavy-set guy, funny guy.
Oh, Peter Ustinov.
Peter Ustinov, yeah. But that I thought was a wonderful film. And looking at the terrain and looking at the people, sort of raw bone quality of the people there. And I thought that, you know, that really reminds me of Texas. Mm-hmm. And my part of Texas. I mean, Harvey grew up near Houston, but that was like almost 900 miles away from where I lived. And like a totally different geography, you know,
yes.
Different terrain, sultry and tropical there where he was.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was dry as a bone, you know.
Indeed, yes. Well, Australia is such a large country that it encompasses very large climatic changes. We have the rainforests up in Queensland, which is the far north of the country, and down here in Victoria it's a much more temperate climate. And going down in the island
yeah.
state of Tasmania, they almost have Arctic conditions because they're very close to the South Pole.
Well, I mean, Australia is a big country, actually, isn't it?
Exactly, yes.
Is it in land mass as big as the United States? Probably it's bigger. You know?
I think it's slightly bigger, actually,
yeah.
If you're thinking about Central America itself.
Yeah.
But the American continent, including Canada and South America, of course, it's smaller than that. But,
No, I just meant the United States. But anyway, what I was leading to in my roundabout way is that has there been a production of 110 in Australia?
No, I don't believe there has been a professional production. I've looked it up. Back in the 1960s, one of the great big producing organizations here was J.C. Williamson's Theatres, and they did stage I Do, I Do. And the Melbourne Theatre Company, or what was the Union Theatre Repertory Company, which later became the Melbourne Theatre Company, staged the first production of The Fantastics here back in 1962. But I don't believe that 110 in the Shade has been given a fully professional production here.
Because it's a strong piece, if I do say so. So somebody should check it out. We did an interesting thing a few years back for a production in Washington, D.C., and then that carried over into the larger production that we did with Audra on Broadway, where we took the cast from the original Broadway cast of 22 people, and Richard Nash was gone, but with the permission of his family, I did some rewrites to bring it down to 9 people.
Yes.
And Jonathan Tunick did new orchestrations for just 7 or 8 instruments, or I think, but very powerful. You know, he's so great.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's a little plug. If people listen to it, I think they'll hear that it's a quality piece, you know.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. But going back to the original production, you write some very interesting things about David Merrick, the original producer, who was quite a character, I believe.
Yes, he was. you know, he was very brilliant and terrific in getting things done. But he was also, to some extent, a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a very funny streak, dark funny streak. But he also had a kind of like cruel streak, too.
Yes.
I was telling you earlier a little story about David Merrick, and if I may, I will tell it again.
Certainly.
And since you heard it, you can go get a cup of tea. A cup of. In that Sundowners, people used to call, you want a cuppa, they'd say. And I don't know if they still say that or not. Anyway, in this story, somebody goes to David Merrick's old office above the Sardi building in the theater district. And they go in, and it's no longer a theater office. You know, it's just an office building. And somebody comes in and gets off the elevator and says, I have an appointment with David Merrick. It's important. And the people look at him, and they say, David Merrick? David Merrick hadn't had an office in this building in 15, 16 years. David Merrick is dead. And he said, oh, my God, yes, of course. And he apologizes, and he leaves. But the next day, at the same time in the afternoon, he comes up in the elevator and said, look, it's really important that I have my appointment with David Merrick. And the man there says, you were here yesterday. He said, didn't you hear what I said? Listen to me. Read my lips. David Merrick is dead. He said, oh, my, yes, you told me that yesterday. I'm sorry. And he leaves, and he doesn't appear for 2 or 3 weeks. And then he comes back again. And he comes in, he says, I demand to see David Merrick. And the guy in the office loses it. He said, are you crazy? Are you deaf? What the hell is the matter with you? Listen to me. David Merrick is dead. David Merrick is dead. David Merrick is dead. And the man says, yes, I know. I just like to hear you say it. So that's the loving memoir of David Merrick.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
And your own experience, I guess. Had you heard tales about David before you started working with him, or was it all new to you, this being?
Oh, no. I'd heard all of these things, and some of them were famous things that he did, and some of them very funny, and then some outrageous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had one of those early Angry Young Men plays from England he'd brought over. And I can't think of it. It was very famous at the time.
Look Back in Anger, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. But it was not doing any business. So without telling the actor, he had hired a woman to go up and climb up on the stage and say, you're just like my boyfriend, and started beating him over the head with her handbag. And it got into all the papers, and it boosted the audience, at least for a little while.
Yes.
But David Merrick, and when we first met him, he just seemed so quiet, and I couldn't believe this was the person I'd heard all these things mm-hmm. about. But oh my God, when we got out on the road, he was just a madman, really. It was like Charlie Chaplin in The Great Dictator, you know. For example, the choreography was by the famous choreographer Agnes DeMille.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Who'd done Oklahoma and lots of things. But he would sit there sometimes in the rehearsal hall. I mean, she wasn't there at the time, but her dancers were there. And he would stomp his foot up and down and say, Agnes DeMille is over the hill.
Ugh.
Agnes DeMille is over the hill. Like on and on and on, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm. And yet he's the one who hired her. So.
And then, ironically, I swore, Harvey and I both swore, we would never, ever work with him again.
Mm-hmm.
And the next show we did on Broadway was produced by David Merrick. Because it was I Do, and we wanted to work with Gower Champion, and he wanted to work with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the project that he brought to us. It was some famous British producer doing it in England, and he said, dear boys, you have to have a title song
mm-hmm.
so everyone can remember the name of the show. For example, Oh Dolly. I think it was the guy, what's his name, Prince Littler or something like that.
Oh, yes, certainly, Prince Littler. Yes, I've heard about
yeah.
him.
Yeah, and he made us write a title song in London for 110 in the Shade. Oh, it's the worst song we ever wrote. It's just so embarrassing. But he felt you had to have a title song.
Mm-hmm.
And I met just as David Merrick was the most important producer in the middle part of the 20th century,
yes,
Cameron Mackintosh was the most important producer of the latter part of the 20th century, you know?
Indeed,
and
yes.
I guess Ziegfeld probably in the early part. But Cameron Mackintosh, when I met him, he had been the stage manager for the London production of 100 in the Shade.
Ah.
And he laughed because he knew that terrible title song we'd written. It was, it's 110 in the shade, every doggone dog. It was just awful. It's shameful, you know.
Yes.
And
I suppose you're happy that it was never recorded.
Oh, it was, the man absolutely made sure it was recorded and there was sheet music.
Oh, okay.
And I think Cameron Mackintosh had the sheet music to prove to me how terrible, he knew how terrible it was.
Yes. But, quite extraordinary.
You know, you mentioned in an email about Stephen Douglas,
mm-hmm.
who is, of course, in the original. And you said he did I Do in Australia, right?
That's correct, yes. He played the male role, of course, and our local actress Jill Perryman played the female role.
I know her name for some reason. Did she come and do some things in New York?
I don't think so. I think she's mainly done, well, she's well retired by now because she's in her 80s, but I think she confined most of her performing activities to Australia. But perhaps you might have heard about her when the production of I Do was being put on.
That must have been it, yes.
Yes, unfortunately, back in the day, they didn't get around to recording Australian casts of things, but I do have a recording of her that she did a concert in Western Australia, which is where she lives these days, singing My Cup Runneth Over with Love. So I can send you a copy of that, accompanied by the Perth Symphony Orchestra. That's one souvenir of the show, but she actually played in the Australian production of Funny Girl over here, playing Fanny Bryce, which brought her great success.
Ah, yes. I've definitely heard her name. My Cup Runneth Over from I Do was the one song we ever had that was number one on the hit parade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nowadays, if you write songs, you don't get any money anyway. It's all just streamed out there. But, you know, you actually made money. And I could remember so vividly after the stress and strain of doing that show out of town again with David Merrick.
Mm-hmm.
Going to St. John in the Caribbean and lying on the beach and listening on my little transistor radio, and they were playing over and over again My Cup or Other. I thought, my God, that's paying for my vacation. And I order me another rum drink, you know, another pina colada.
Yes, yes. Well, you'll be pleased to know that we still play it on our radio station too, because we sort of cover the wide gamut of music, including nostalgia and middle-of-the-road music, and generally we get to hear Ed Ames performing My Cup Runneth Over with Love on one program or another, so it's still being played out here in Australia too.
Well, that's good. I hope maybe they'll, on ASCAP, maybe somewhere I get a nickel out of that. you don't have nickels in Australia, do you?
No. Well, no, we do have decimal currency, but it's just known as 10 cents, 5 cents, 2 cents. So.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
You do. Mm-hmm. And do you have, like in England, the tuppenny and all those things, you know, halfpence, tuppenny stuff?
Yes, we used to. We used to follow the English monetary system up to 1966, but that's when they decided to decimalise the currency. So before 1966, we had pounds, shillings and pence and halfpennies and tuppennies and farthings and sovereigns and all the rest of the English money.
Crowns.
Crowns, indeed. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We're here to sell tickets to 110 in the Shade.
Certainly, okay. And I believe the original role of the Rainmaker was to be played by Hal Holbrook, but again, David Merrick decided that he'd have one up on Richard Rodgers, who he saw as an arch rival.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, he hated Richard Rodgers. I think he had tried to get Richard Rodgers and Rodgers and Hammerstein to write the score for Fanny,
mm-hmm.
you know, the musical Fanny, one of his first successes.
Yes.
But Rodgers and Hammerstein wouldn't do it unless they were like co-producers. Anyway, but he would, for example, I think I mentioned in that little article, If he went to someplace like the Rainbow Room, these famous things where the orchestras were famous orchestras, mm-hmm. and he saw Richard Rodgers come in, he would have one of his henchmen, David, go up and give the orchestra leader $1,000 not to play any Richard Rodgers songs. So that Richard Rodgers is sitting there kind of wondering why they're not playing any of his music, you know, and wondering if he's losing it.
Quite an incredible man.
Yeah.
And so I believe that the chap who was cast in the role of the Rainmaker, of course, Starbuck, Robert Horton, was going to be a leading man in one of Richard Rodgers' musicals.
That was, yes. I mean, we had cast Hal Holbrook, and he would have been interesting, a different kind of Starbuck, which I think would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a tendency with Starbucks to be kind of like Mama's Little Dress-Up Cowboy, you know.
Yes.
And it's very easy to slip into a kind of cliche macho thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Hal Holbrook would have been kind of like a little bit like crazier and the con man, and maybe even somebody like in Richard Nash himself,
mm-hmm.
like somebody from the outside world who's assuming this. And it's, like with his little wagon, he's a con man, you know?
Yes, yes.
He's not necessarily a real cowboy, you know? He's something else.
Mm-hmm.
He's a traveling trickster. Anyway, and then we had a great, wonderful man playing her father.
Oh, Will Gear, yes.
Will Gear.
Perhaps best remembered for the Waltons.
Yes, he was in the Waltons, and Will Gear was the most extraordinary man, really.
Mm-hmm.
He, back in the 30s and 40s, he was Woody Guthrie's closest friend.
Okay.
And when Woody Guthrie got sick, he sort of helped take care of Arlo and handle the affairs of the Woody Guthrie Foundation. And at one point, Will Gear's mother-in-law was Mother Bloor, head of the Communist Party of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So when the blacklisting took place in the 50s, he couldn't get any work, you know. But 110 The Shade was his first. He'd done some off-Broadway things and a lot of Shakespeare at the Shakespeare Festival in Connecticut.
Yes.
But 110 was his first Broadway credit after being blacklisted. Mm-hmm. And he was an extraordinary man. He was a life force, you know.
Yes.
He made it, and he really did this. He made a new friend every day, and he wrote a letter to somebody every day.
Ah.
But then he was in New York for the year, running for a year there.
Yes.
And then it went on the road for a year. And Will wrote it into his, David Merrick couldn't believe it. Will wrote it into his contract that he had to be released from the tour for 1 week at the first black frost on the East Coast so he could bring in his crops. and David Merrick couldn't believe it. But the topper of the story is that came up, the first black frost
mm-hmm.
came up when the tour was in San Diego in California, and they gave him the week off, and Will ran off to Mexico with one of the chorus boys for a week.
No.
Will, I think, you know, loved men, women, trees. I mean, he was a great cultivator. He created at the Shakespeare Theater in Connecticut
mm-hmm.
a beautiful Shakespeare garden, you know, with only plants that are mentioned in Shakespeare's plays and so forth.
Yes.
And then he went out, and then after 110, and he did some interesting movies as well as the Waltons, a film called Jeremiah Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see that? Jeremiah Johnson with Sundance Kid, you know.
Robert Redford?
Robert Redford, right.
Mm-hmm.
And Will was very good in it. And he went out in California with the success of the Waltons. He bought a piece of land on Topanga Canyon
mm-hmm.
and he built a theater there, and he had a free theater that he kept going until he died there. And then his daughter, Ellen Gear, mm-hmm. took over. I think she runs it now.
Ah, great. Quite a character indeed. And as part of the creative team, you and Harvey, did you have any say in the casting? Because you wanted suitable voices to sing the songs that you'd written. Did you have any say in the casting, or was all that left to the...
Oh, no, we did the casting, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, along with the director, Joe Anthony. He had directed the television version,
mm-hmm.
and so he directed the play, and he directed the Broadway version of the play, and he directed the movie with Katharine Hepburn, too, and then he directed the musical. So
he's the man who knew the most about the show, obviously.
Right. And a long time ago, really. Hundreds in the Shade was 1963, I think, in October. Yeah. I know that just a few weeks after we opened, Kennedy was assassinated.
Mm.
And so the world was in the process of getting darker and stranger already, even then, you know?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I remember is that the Surgeon General report came out about smoking and cancer. And after having smoked since I was like 14 years old, I actually stopped that day. And stopped smoking and started drinking.
Oh, well, I suppose 60 years later, almost 60 years later, at least you're feeling the benefits of it. So you're still hale and hearty at the age of 92.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yes, I got just a couple of more things to write, and then I don't mind
mm-hmm.
moving on. I have Maud say in the musical version of Harold and Maud. She's talking to Harold when she first meets him. She says, they were at a funeral. She said, did you know him? And he says, no. She said, me either. Somebody said he was 85. She says, that's a good age, don't you think? And Harold says, a good age. She says, to pass on, to rearrange, so to speak. And that's the way I feel. And then she has a really, I think, a terrific song called Round and Round the Cosmic Dance.
Mm-hmm.
Births and deaths and births again, joy, despair, romance, in and out the circle spin, it's the cosmic dance.
Mm-hmm.
See the lovers bending low, see the seed beneath the snow, out of darkness life can grow. This is what I've found, we are in a cosmic dance spinning round and round. And that's what I feel, you know.
Yes, yes. Great. And I guess these days, the thing is with new shows that you workshop them so that you get some sense of it. Whereas back in the days, of course, you had these pre-Broadway previews, which is economically not feasible these days.
No, they was fun, though. I mean, it really was. I mean, God, they were scary. I mean, they were like, you know, if you're out of town with a show and you go down in the elevator, and suddenly the door opens, you see Jerry Herman coming out in the hotel. You think, oh, wait a minute, what's he doing here? You know, or Comlin and Green.
Uh-huh.
And you think, oh, my God, I'm going to get back to work, you know. But I love room service. And so, and per diem, those are two great things. You put those two together, and no matter how rough it is out of town, that's a little joy when you get both room service and per diem,
uh-huh.
and mix them together.
Indeed. And yes, I believe you wrote one of the songs, the 110 in the Shade, was written out of town, the first act closer.
Actually, several songs were written out of town, despite the fact we'd already written 100 songs.
Yes.
But the song A Man and a Woman in Boston, right before the Old Maid song,
mm-hmm.
It made a huge difference to the show. And we wrote it in one night, and Hershey Kay, great orchestrator, orchestrated it in one day. And then the assistant stage manager, a great dame named Mae Muth, mm-hmm. I loved Mae Muth, stood in the orchestra pit with cardboard cue cards.
Okay.
So, and then Inga, because they just were given the song like 2 hours before curtain time or something like that.
Yes.
And Inga and Steve Douglas came right down to my favorite place for actors to be, downstage center.
Mm-hmm.
And they would sing the song, but they could look, and Mae Muth could show the lyrics to them, you know.
Yes, yes.
I tell a short, very short story about Mae Muth. who had been a Broadway hoofer, a dancer back in the 30s, you know, mm-hmm. and such a Bronx accent like you never heard before, and dyed red hair. She was stage managing a tour of Oklahoma, mm-hmm. so the story goes. And I think maybe Barbara Cook was playing Ada Annie. Yeah, very young Barbara. And Barbara Cook and her understudy went and had supper together. And they ate some kind of food poisoning. So yeah. by the end of the first act, neither Ada Annie nor her understudy could go on.
Oh, dear.
So Maymuth put on the costume and went on stage and said, "Hi, I'm Ada Annie's cousin from New York." And played the rest of the show. I think they should. The stage manager should have a Maymuth Award.
Great presence of mind to do something like that.
Yes, and great balls, so to speak.
Indeed, yes.
More or less. Anyway, okay, well, that may be a good way. Let's close out on Maymuth, and God rest her soul wherever she is. I adored her, you know.
Great. And well, it's been a great delight speaking with you once again, Tom, and I look forward to us chatting again in the future.
Yes, good. Bye.
Bye for now. You've been listening to an archival interview that I recorded with the now sadly late Tom Jones via Skype from his ranch in Connecticut in May of 2020. And happily, I did have the opportunity to speak with Tom on further occasions, and those interviews shall be heard on future editions of Musical Theatre Melodies.